I'm Kay Firth Butterfield at the World Economic Forum.
And I'm Miriam Vogel with Equal AI. And this is In AI We Trust. Hello and welcome back to In AI We Trust. Today we are so pleased to be joined by KJ Bagchi, who serves as Vice President of the Center for Civil Rights and Technology, founded by the Leadership Conference Education Fund. Previously, KJ served as Vice President of Technology Policy at the Chamber of Progress. He is a veteran of Capitol Hill and public interest organizations, including having served as Senior Policy Counsel at New America's Open Technology Institute. KJ has more than 10 years of experience in public policy and legislative strategy at local, state, and federal levels, and led the reestablishment of the Technology, Telecommunications, and Media Program during his tenure as Senior Counsel for Asian Americans Advancing Justice. In addition to advising members of the Washington State Senate, Bagchi worked as Legislative Counsel for a DC City Council member and former Congressman. Thank you so much, KJ, for joining us today.
Yeah, and thanks for having me on.
So as you may know, it was likewise my interest in civil rights law that initially led me to help work in the AI space and establish Equal AI with an understanding of how the power of AI could either support or dramatically impede progress in the civil rights space. And so I'd love to just start us off with learning more about what was the incident or the path that led you to incorporate artificial intelligence into your work on civil rights.
Yeah, so I think for me, coming out of law school, I'd always worked in arenas where I had a very specific constituency. My first job out of law school was for the DC City Council, working for a council member. I then worked on the Hill, as you mentioned in the introduction, and worked for a member there. So I knew who our constituency was. When I came to a decision of trying to decide what to do next in the sort of career trajectory, the idea of working in civil society to help build strategies there to influence policymaking was an idea that a mentor of mine sort of brought to my attention. And so thinking through what type of organization I would want to support and work with, the first organization was Asian Americans Advancing Justice, AAJC. They're an Asian American civil rights organization, and they were setting up their tech policy shop. And that was really my first foray into the sort of tech and civil rights intersection. Prior to that, I'd worked on consumer protection issues, civil rights and civil liberties issues. But that first foray into seeing that this is a new growing area, tech policy generally, but specifically as AI started to go from being a conversation that only those of us in the tech policy space were thinking about to seeing how generative AI sort of created a sort of fast forward to where we are today. Working on tech policy issues with the AAJC, continuing that work with New America, I had a real deep interest in was coming back to the civil rights arena to, again, know exactly who am I serving when it comes to these issues. And so I think for me, what has been important to understand and to really start educating the public about in our own coalition members at Leadership Conference about is that traditional civil rights arenas are now all interacting with some sort of automated system, whether that's immigration, housing, and access to credit, the criminal justice system. And so for those reasons, coming to the Leadership Conference to do this work was sort of the driving impetus, again, knowing very clearly the constituency that I'm working to serve.
And knowing your constituency, knowing who you're serving, it'd be helpful to learn more about the initiative, the center. What are the goals? What do you hope to accomplish in the short term? And what are the specific needs you intend to address with this center?
Yeah, so I think, the sort of groundbreaking nature of the center is that we have never seen up until now a legacy civil rights organization like the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights dedicate significant resources into building a sort of tech policy shop that we're seeing right now. And so that's what the center, we were founded last year. Our president and CEO, Maya Wiley, began to sort of forecast where a lot of the traditional civil rights arenas were heading into. They were all interacting with some sort of automated system, some sort of technological process. And so the idea of creating a center that would serve as a strategic hub within our organization to connect those folks who are working on housing, for example, or working on criminal justice with the sort of tech policy experts was one goal. But the second goal was also our coalition at the Leadership Conference is over 240 organizations that focus on civil and human rights. And so for them, these different organizations to have a strategic hub where they can turn to and say, look, we know we're focusing on X issue. We know this is impacting what we're working on. We would love to have a center, having a center that can provide resources, education, can help strategize on advocacy, avenues has been important. When we sort of zoom out a little bit and think about the actual goals of the center, it's really threefold. The first is advocacy, whether that be on the Hill, the executive branch, even through amicus briefs. The second is education, public education, lawmaker education, as well as educating our own coalition. And the final aspect, this sort of final pillar, is that of research. And research is a whole new, for at least the leadership conference and its tech policy work, it's a whole new sort of apparatus that we're engaging in, which means that we'll be developing deeper ties with academics. We'll be producing white papers, blogs, reports, and so on. We have our advisory council that we'll be announcing in the next few weeks, which is a combination of civil rights organizations principals that are part of our coalition and a number of academics. And the goal here is, again, to deepen our relationships and to have, again, I use the word strategy because I think that is something we would argue has been lacking overall in sort of the civil rights angle on a lot of these tech policy issues. But we'll be announcing the advisory council to focus on, again, enhancing our research work there.
This is so exciting. As you know, at Equal AI, we are thrilled for your existence. I mean, we asked the question to share with the listeners what the need is, but we're very aware of the gap that you're filling and how important it is that you exist. So we're just beyond thrilled. And as you know, from the moment we met you, we wanted to make sure that your center is showcased in our work and on our podcast. And it's because we, like you, understand that all the progress that has been made can be undone in the civil rights arena in lines of code. And the particular challenge here is it can happen without the perpetrators even knowing that they are discriminating, that they're harming. Hopefully, on the flip side, there's also a lot of opportunity to do good with AI. And so clearly, with these three goals you've articulated, you'll be filling that need. And I can't wait to dig in more on how you're going to be filling the need in these three specific areas. But before that, I also wanted to touch base with you and go a little deeper. You mentioned on the issues you're going to be focused on, and there are so many, but you mentioned housing, criminal justice, credit. Which do you see as the most significant civil rights issues posed by AI? We heard in the Insight Forum, we were able to hear from Maya Wiley articulate some of this vision, but we'd just love to hear from you. What do you see as the top threats from AI right now?
You know, I think there are many ways to answer that question, right? And so I'll start with one angle, and that is the concerns that we're raising around AI and the perpetuation of this technology, proliferation of this technology, are the same concerns we've been raising with data privacy practices, right? The ability to collect data in a way where consumers are not aware of what is being collected, and also to have that data used against them in another setting. What we've thought about in the past have been how, for example, what came up with Cambridge Analytica, where you have data brokers playing a role in creating psychological profiles that can be weaponized against communities of color. We think through data brokers selling data to government entities in the immigration aspect. We know that ICE and DHS have used this data. So again, the concern is always, there is this excitement that we have for tech itself, but when you balance that with potential impact on communities, that's where the risk rises. The concern is that all these issues are happening at once, right? And so right now, if we're thinking about a specific topic, like we can look at the voting area right now. And in 2024, that's been a pretty significant concern for us, the idea that AI will essentially spread this misinformation at warp speeds. But there are also other areas of AI that we know have existed even prior to like the big conversation we're having right in the last few years. That is with facial recognition technology being used by immigration officers, being used by law enforcement agencies at the federal level and also at the local level. And so to think through the civil rights risk that we've been ringing the alarm for, all these areas are being impacted by that. So it's hard for me to rank in terms of like what is the most significant risk. Some of these battles are old, and some of the focuses right now are really on how voting, since we're in an election year, voting is especially an area that we focus on.
Well, thank you for so well handling and taking on that really hard, an almost unfair question, because there's just too much need to preclude all of them as being part of that answer, but really helpful to hear from your perspective and certainly understand the timeliness of the voting issue, as well as the others you mentioned. And going back to the three goals you articulated, advocacy being the first, how timely, given that we've seen Capitol Hill talking about AI. It's gone from quarterly to daily for a while, and sometimes even two hearings a day on AI in the last year, let alone what's happening at the state and local legislatures across this country and the government bodies across the globe. So I'm curious, I know it's early days, but do you have a sense of what you would be and will be asking for of these legislatures? Is there immediate action that you're asking them to take? Are there significant frameworks that you're hoping that they will establish? You mentioned data privacy and other areas that are traditional areas of focus and concern. Will one of those be your top priorities in those advocacy conversations?
So I think there are multiple lines that are moving, lines of sort of communication and engagement that are moving right now that we're trying to engage on. And I wouldn't be doing right by my civil society friends, you know, brothers and sisters, if I didn't call out the ADPPA, which is, again, the comprehensive privacy bill that we have been arguing for quite some time is needed. Because again, all these AI tools, products and systems are all powered by just massive amounts of data. And the ADPPA had protections in that legislation that focused on making sure that any sort of AI tool cannot implicate or cannot harm the civil rights protections of an individual. So I think, you know, we continue to ring that alarm saying like, look, let's take it up again. It's a bipartisan bill. But in terms of AI specifically and sort of frameworks on that, we're definitely being responsive to the executive order and the OMB guidance. So there was OMB guidance draft memo. We responded to that, talked about some of our concerns with that framework. Again, the implications, the sort of impact on that framework is only the executive branch and in agencies, and also, of course, vendors that are playing in that procurement process with the federal government. And so we've given feedback on that sort of framework. I can call out one of the major concerns we had. The draft memo called for chief AI officers to be named in each of the agencies, gave them the power to grant waivers from some of the guardrails that were being laid out in the memo. And so we called this out saying, like, look, like, what is the check on the chief AI officers themselves? The final area that we're looking at are the states, right? Specifically California. California Assemblymember Bauer Cahan has an AI bill that prohibits the use of AI that discriminates, and it requires impact assessments, and it imposes other safeguards, including transparency and testing. And so while we don't specifically engage in state legislation, we're not advocating on the ground in states. We do look at those as models that other states can pick up on, and also to bring it to the federal government, to Congress themselves and other lawmakers who are thinking about how to engage on these issues.
That makes good sense. And as you're talking to different regulatory bodies and lawmakers, there's often this misnomer that AI is unregulated, that we're in a lawless environment at the moment. But as we well know, there are several civil rights laws and others that are effective whether you're using AI or not. There are numerous federal and state regulatory bodies who've spoken to their authorities in the AI space. I think the FTC has been talking about this for 5 years. The EEOC has had an initiative for 4 years on AI. So I'm curious, in your work, which are the civil rights laws and enforcement authorities that you like to highlight and make sure companies, organizations, individuals know that AI is applicable and could be impacted, could be litigated, could be under scrutiny if they're not mindful of these laws?
Yeah, so I think the EEOC has definitely been, you know, and Chair Burroughs over there has definitely done a great job in bringing that agency into 2024 and the threats that we see with some of these tools being used in the employment context. The guidance she gave to employers talking about how Title VII violations can still occur even if it is an automated system. And again, this big question that we're all having around AI governance is liability. Who is actually liable for the sort of the negative impact brought on by the use of these products and tools? And so in the employment context, I think that guidance was important. The example I use, I've definitely become, I joke with Commissioner Bedoya when he spoke at our event, that I've become a huge hype man for the Rite Aid settlement that the FTC brought down because, and it, you know, just kind of reminding your listeners, in this Rite Aid settlement, the FTC basically ordered Rite Aid to not use facial recognition technology for a straight ban for 5 years, but it implicated and included a number of criteria that must be undertaken before that company can utilize that sort of technology again. Now, putting aside the fact that I'm not even sure if Rite Aid is, if they're going bankrupt or what, or if they're closing down more and more stores, but I see it as the actual settlement is a good example of how an agency can use its existing powers to take action against private sector actors when we see actual harm being done to consumers there. So this is, again, it's not using a civil rights law, but we know the implications when you have people of color being denied access into a store because of erroneous technology. The implications and the tools the agencies have to use, they have to be creative. Right? We don't have a civil right protection for AI tools at this point. We don't even have data privacy context here in the States. And so again, for agencies to think through how to use their existing power to enforce against these sort of actions is important. And so we definitely point to the FTC. I think with the EEOC, it's difficult because again, it was just guidance. I think there's a little bit of, you know, they have their hands tied a little bit there. But again, as more agencies start to think through where they can become active, we point to these folks as a good example.
Yeah, thank you for that helpful illustration for anyone who has not been following. Clearly a statement from the FTC on how they will use any authority within their power to use their authorities to ensure that civil rights laws are put to best use and that facial recognition in particular in this case is going to be heavily scrutinized. And so looking to the work outside of the law, we can look to regulators and lawmakers to create new legislations to enforce those on the books. But we know that there's still so much that needs to happen within each organization, within each company to ensure that they're doing the right thing, whether or not a regulator is scrutinizing their work. So I'm curious if you have steps that you tell a company that they should take if they want to do the right thing, if they want to be a responsible AI actor, if they want to be mindful of civil rights and civil liberties protections using AI, is there guidance you give them for when they are either developing or deploying AI systems?
So I'll admit that we have not seen, at least in my 4 or 5 months on the job, I've not seen much engagement from the private industry reaching out to civil society and specifically the leadership conference to get feedback on the specific steps they should take to ensure that their tools and products are safe. So, you know, to that end, I think you were talking about sort of what do we hope to develop. We are working as a team to figure out what specific guidance look like in the case where a company would come to us and say, what can we do to ensure that we're being proactive in creating a safe product here? I would say generally, again, not being able to point to a specific manual or kind of output that we've created, generally the idea of engaging impacted communities in developing any kind of tool or product is really critical. We brought this up in previous filings around this topic of AI. The other issues are, again, how do we think about impact? If something is privacy impacting, if it's safety impacting, if it's going to actually harm individuals, and the level of scrutiny that needs to be applied should be significant, right? And that means that there should be a different level of tests and internal review that should happen that is different from, say, other products that may have no impact on the civil rights of an individual or the safety of an individual. Generally, accountability mechanisms, looking at how design, development, deployment are critical. We also talk about continual testing, continually doing impact assessments. And if there's anything that gives any sort of signal that there's some sort of harm that could be created, to take that product off the market or take that system offline immediately. That's generally how we would guide folks if they were to come to talk to us. But generally, I'll say, like, this has been a little concerning where we haven't seen bigger tech companies that we've worked with on other sort of conversations around, say, like privacy. And when they put out, I want to say years ago, when they would put out sort of privacy frameworks and they would talk to us about what they want to see, we haven't seen that same interest in engaging civil society actively, at least from where I'm sitting, on the development of their AI tools, the development of generative AI, the development of some of these image generators that we've been hearing about, how it caused some controversy and got taken off offline. And so my hope with the center is also to create a forum where it's not just about civil society being sort of empowered to engage. It's also for industry to find a place where they can actually come to and be like, look, those who want a one-stop shop civil society kind of engagement, for us to engage directly as a center, but also to say, look, here are organizations that are focused on healthcare. Here are organizations that are focused on the criminal justice aspect or people with disabilities. If you're thinking about how your product may impact that community, here are the groups to go to.
Well, that is fascinating. I think these are great suggestions as to how you would advise a company. And I think giving specific guidance on how to engage impacted communities, risk assessments, I think I'm glad to hear that this is a need you are looking to fill, because we are very happy to help partner with you and make sure that the companies we're working with are benefiting from your insights. And certainly we have similar messages. Our realm, we always are channeling Kathy O'Neill, who has taught us, for whom could this fail? Needs to be the repeated question, and making sure that whatever audit system you're using, whatever use cases you're envisioning, to constantly be asking ourselves that question. Again, wherever you are in the AI lifecycle, but we'll be delighted to help make sure that the companies we're working with who are wanting to lead in responsible AI are able to benefit from your insights and guidance as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I do want to add that I do think organizations such as Equal AI, right, and other folks who are really honing in on responsible AI from that technical aspect. And I think there's a lot of important work that Equal AI that you folks do on this. I think the concern I brought up was more about looking at legacy civil rights organizations that have been thinking about discrimination in a sort of in a different perspective and in a different context, and to bring some of that history into these conversations as these tools are developed. But no, I love the idea of partnership. And so, yeah, we'd definitely love to have some of those conversations that that you were able to open up for us.
Fantastic. Well, we will look forward to that. One question I also have for you is we often talk about AI as offering opportunity if it's managed, if it's created, developed appropriately. And I'm curious, do you think AI can be part of the solution in expanding civil rights and creating opportunity? Do you think AI can be part of how we ensure there is more justice and wider application of civil rights?
Yeah, and I think despite maybe the tone I brought to some of these questions, I know I may sound like I'm more skeptical of tech. The truth is I am a tech optimist, right? I believe, and that's why I got into this space and continue to grow my career in this space, to grow the network and the conversations I've had. I think the strongest sort of illustrative example for me to respond to your question about do I think AI can be part of the solution is to look at autonomous vehicles, right? The amount of sort of, you know, in my previous role at Chamber of Progress, we would work with a number of AV companies. You know, I also had the opportunity to actually drive in a right driverless, you know, autonomous vehicle. And so it was amazing, right? You go into the vehicle, you're putting your trust in this, essentially this gigantic computer with wheels, and the amount of data that must be used to power that system is important, right? It's essentially seeing what road to turn onto. It can see obstacles far in advance and knows how to maneuver around them. So I think, again, the ability for AVs to be a connector of maybe communities in a large city that would not, you know, would be difficult to connect, to deal with mobility issues, to deal with environmental impact, to reduce traffic, right, to reduce pedestrian deaths. I think these are all positive values. But then when you look at some of the studies around AVs and you see that they have a harder time recognizing people with darker skin tone, that's where the importance of testing these systems to ensure that whatever these products are put on the road that literally can impact the safety or the lives of these individuals who are walking, right, pedestrians who are walking on the street or other vehicles on the road, becomes really critical. And so for me, it's, am I hopeful? Am I optimistic about AI? And do I think the possibilities are great? Absolutely. I think the work that's focused on climate change now, I think the work being done to assist farmers to sort of think through how to grow higher yield crops and all that, I think that is all amazing. Our concern from the civil rights community is when it actually impacts people, when there's a chance of impacting my ability to access credit, my ability to apply for a job and get denied and not know why, my ability to apply for benefits, but there's an algorithm behind the scenes that's deciding that I don't get access to that public benefit and I don't have the right to appeal because I don't know how that decision was come to. That's where we become concerned when it becomes more human-based. But overall, I do think civil society has learned from the battles of 2017 when data privacy sort of kind of came to the forefront post Cambridge Analytica. I think the conversations we're seeing between private industry and civil society and government, frankly, and lawmakers, you see lawmakers really getting up to speed on these topics. I know you had Congressman Ted Lieu on your podcast a while back, and he's been doing great work there. And so I'm optimistic for that. I think we're all aware that potential harm here is significant. And everyone truly is trying to do their best, I would argue, right? From like not being able to read everyone's mind, but like I do think most folks are trying to be supportive and trying to find a way to create good product that make life more convenient for us and are not hurting people or harming folks. So I'm sort of optimistic in that sense. I do think AI can be part of specific solutions, but I think if it's about access to traditional civil rights areas, I do get a little wary about what those guardrails would look like. And the fact that there hasn't been much action from Congress to act on this.
Yeah. And speaking of concerns and imminent activities, you mentioned your focus on the election. Curious to hear what ways that you're working in this space right now, how you're focusing on AI and the election. How are you imagining that it will have an influence? How are you encouraging best practices? How are you thinking overall that AI will impact democracy?
Yeah, I think the answer to that is in many significant ways, right? I think part of any democratic system is you want a educated populace, or you want folks to be aware of not just the candidates, but also where to vote, right? And what location to go to, when to vote. I think the concerns, we've already started to see how AI has been used in terms of creating deepfakes, in terms of imitating voices, and how it's been used to essentially confuse an electorate to participate in the system. I think the other place where we play significantly is that the platforms, specifically with YouTube and with Facebook, we know that in past elections, the spread of misinformation, disinformation has been significant on the platforms. We work obviously with lawmakers to try to find ways to regulate here, but this is difficult. You can't pass a law to say all content that has XYZ information should be taken down. We know that would face significant constitutional challenges. So no one's trying to advocate for that on the lawmaker side. So we work directly with companies to say, look, your policy on, for example, the big lie, right? Where YouTube and Facebook both have said they're not going to take down content that claims that the 2020 election was stolen. A lot of the disinformation, misinformation are all sort of seeds of that, right? It's all stemming from that one falsehood that has been disproven. And so we'll work with companies directly to say, look, like this is something that is of concern. And if you're not going to change the policy, then give us metrics of if this sort of content you've seen has been violative of other policies you have, great, you have protections in place. Give us metrics on how many times you've actually moved on that. So that has been the sort of direct work with the platforms that we know will be sort of one battleground of spreading misinformation, disinformation. To that end, at the leadership conference prior to my even arrival, we have an apparatus where we are essentially tracking voter misinformation, disinformation. We then work to create inoculation messaging, and we spread that inoculation messaging through our various networks that focus on voter mobilization. And so that has been another active way to respond to what's happening. But we know there are things that we can't necessarily fight back on or respond to quickly. For example, we know that phone calls, right, when you get these robocalls with a imitative voice, those are some things that are beyond our immediate capacity to handle. And so that's where we do get concerned about what can be done there. We know that the FCC and others have sort of stepped in here saying, like, we're going to stop these types of robocalls. That has had implications. But again, there's only so much civil society can take on, and we're going to do all we can, especially in a critical year. But my 4 months, I think I've been to at least 3 or 4 different voting rights and AI convenings with various different groups. And the scenario building goes from super horrifying to, well, this is manageable, but it's going to take a lot of capacity building from all of our communities and all of our organizations across the sort of spectrum.
Yeah. Well, speaking of, as you build your infrastructure and build out on these 3 important goals you mentioned, can you tell us more about some of the education you're going to do with the coalition, some of the research either that you have underway or expect to do, and how can people be helpful in your work?
Sure. Yeah. So I think let me talk about a little bit about the sort of education aspect. So we know that the final OMB AI guidance final draft is going to be released in the next few weeks. Something that our team is ready to do is to essentially take that in coordination with the White House AI executive order and to identify issue areas that are implicated. And based on those different categories of issues, so healthcare, criminal justice, housing, we will then disseminate that information to the organizations within our coalition that are actually working on these issues. Another sort of apparatus that we have at the leadership conference, we have task forces that focus on different issues. That's one area where a lot of our coalition organizations kind of come together. So the goal will be for our staff to do simple presentations about this is what came out in the final OMB draft, OMB memo. This is how this kind of puts teeth behind the AI executive order. Folks should be aware of this. The reason I didn't mention this at the very top. We know the AI executive order was very ambitious in the sort of timelines and the requirements it had on asking agencies to take certain actions. And so part of our goal is to get civil society, our coalition specifically, to be very active in being part of the accountability measures, right? To be an accountability check on government, on the agencies as they start going through these requirements in the executive order. So, I mean, on an education aspect, that's been one example of where we're going. On the research aspect, again, we're very new. So I think mainly it's been bringing potential fellows to work with us, academic fellows to work with us. And so one area we know there's a little bit of interest is to put out reports and white papers on the sort of intersection between AI and workforce, AI and employment. How will this impact workforces? How will this impact people of color, specific ethnic groups within the workforce? And to see what we can do to sort of counter and curb some of those negative impacts. What policies can we pursue? Help from the public in general, I think just obviously supporting our work. I think when we do start really ramping up and we will start building campaigns and trying to activate the public to engage on some of these issues, it'll be important for those folks to kind of take notice. A lot of things I also, you noted this very early in our conversation, that a lot of harms by AI are unseen. Sometimes you don't know if you're actually being impacted by the systems. What we're also starting to collect are stories. I think for individuals among your listener base, if folks are hearing about potential impacts between AI systems and marginalized communities or anyone, we would love to have those, hear those stories. I think we found when talking to Congress, especially, as you know, there's a significant age gap, generation gap between staffers and actual lawmakers. So the way to connect that gap one way has been to actually build stories and to lift those up in these conversations. I would say that's something that we've started to build up. We haven't really given it a snazzy name yet, but it's a story database right now that we started to put together based on just news stories that fellows and interns come through. We have staff kind of, you know, dumping stories into this database, starting to categorize it based on issue area and how recent these issues are or the interaction that happened. So those are sort of the overview of like what we're doing in the research education space and where the public can really help out.
Well, I'm so glad you shared that. I will look forward to being a beneficiary, learning from those stories myself, and we'd love to spread the word. Love what you're going to be doing on the workforce. So sign us up at Equal AI to support in any way. We are thrilled that your position, your center now exists, and that our listeners will now know more about it and find ways that they can be helpful. And I'm so sorry that our show is coming to a close, but I know you've mentioned some of the few of the many ways that you are so busy. So we need to let you get back to your work. And before we let you go, I want to make sure we ask you the last question that we ask all of our guests. And that is, what is the AI innovation you are most excited to see come to fruition?
Yeah, I think the role that digital assistants have played in the past, right? Making life just more convenient. If we get to a point where those digital assistants can actually get to a point of providing information that is helpful, and thinking of interactions between people of color and law enforcement for these tools to kind of explain that in a way that is safe and legal so that communities can become more educated about those interactions and we can avoid some of the harms and horror stories we've seen. It's also, I think, as long as these tools help individuals understand what their rights are and can help them be educated on whatever systems or processes are happening around them, I think that to me is where I'm most hopeful. I think generative AI, when it popped out, we started seeing these large language models be responsive in ways that we could never have dreamed of before. I think that was really exciting. And I share that excitement with all my colleagues and across this whole tech policy ecosystem, whether it be civil society, government, or private sector. And so again, all we're doing here on the civil society side is just trying to build guardrails to make sure that any kind of innovation is equitable. If it's leaving people behind or harming folks, it's not really innovation. That's been our theme in the work that we do. So excited to see technology like that come into fruition.
As are we. Couldn't have said it better. KJ, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for the really important work you're doing.
Awesome. Thank you, Miriam.
Subscribe to or download our podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. We always welcome your feedback. And if you like the podcast, please rate us or give us a review. To learn more or get involved, visit us at www.equalai.org and www.weforum.org.
And a special thanks to NP Agency, without whom this podcast would not be possible.